evening and welcome to Outbeat Collage Out in the Arts. I'm Michaela Kennan, flying solo tonight as my co-host, Gary Carnevale, winds his way home from vacation. Mary Moore Campagna is on the engineering boards. Tonight's show is all about navigating between worlds, kind of about finding our place, about being an active participant in helping to raise our collective consciousness and better the world for it. We'll begin in San Francisco. Hear a conversation I had recently with social activist and visual artist Lenore Chen. Then, here in studio, we'll chat with local writer, speaker, and psychotherapist Jan Ogren, who will talk to us about the release of her new book, Dividing Worlds, offer up a few insights on living mystically in the changing world around us. As always, it promises to be a fascinating evening. To start it off, here's Greg Moralia with the Outbeat News.
Say it. Tell it like it is.
Good evening. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for Sunday, October 16th, 2011. Trailblazing gay activist, astronomer, and World War II veteran Frank Kameny passed away Tuesday at the age of 86. Kameny was an early pioneer in taking the Pentagon to task for discharging gays and lesbians. In 1961, Kameny filed a lawsuit challenging his discharge from the Army MAP service because he was gay, decades before the U.S. Supreme Court declared sodomy laws unconstitutional in Lawrence v. Texas in 2003. He led a demonstration against the military in 1965, and his death comes just weeks after a new era began in the military as gays and lesbians began serving openly after Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. Kameny and the city's local Mattachine Society chapter took Washington, D.C. by storm for its treatment of gay federal employees. After years of protest, the Civil Service Commission, now known as the Office of Personnel Management, announced it would end its ban on openly gay employees in 1973. He was also instrumental in pushing the American Psychiatric Association to declassify homosexuality as a mental illness. In 2009, Kameny received a formal apology from the Office of Personnel Management for being fired because of his sexual orientation. He was also honored by the Obama administration when the president signed a policy to extend benefits to same-sex partners of federal employees. And here in California, while activists battle conservative lawmakers over things like Don't Say Gay in Tennessee, California found itself with both a legislature and a governor willing to pass LGBT-supportive bills. As of this week, California Governor Jerry Brown has signed 10 new bills into law since January of 2011. They deal with a range of issues, including education and judicial appointments. State Senator Christine Cahill called Brown's most recent approval of 7 laws just this last Monday, quote, a watershed year in the California legislature. One of the bills signed this week is designed to create a more accepting and safe environment for LGBT students on college and university campuses. AB 620, the Equality and Equal Access in Higher Education Law, requests the governing bodies of California State Universities, University of California's, and every community college district to adopt and enforce policies on harassment, intimidation, and bullying. It also requires each campus to have at least one employee charged with addressing the needs of LGBT faculty, students, and staff. The bill has also revised the definition of gender to include gender expression. Other laws passed this year include requiring schools to establish strong policies protecting students against bullying, one to require LGBT history to be included in public school curriculum, and one that corrects 3 differences between marriage and domestic partnerships, including requirements that same-sex couples live together before entering into a domestic partnership. And on a related note, challengers of California's new Fair Education Act, the one I just spoke of requiring public schools to include LGBT history into their curriculum, failed to secure the signatures needed to place a referendum on the ballot this November that would have overturned the law. Opponents used a variety of deceitful methods in an attempt to gather the required number of signatures, but fortunately failed in their attempt to keep LGBT history out of our classrooms. And earlier this month, Equality California, the state's largest LGBT rights group, announced that it will not lead an effort to repeal Proposition 8 on the 2012 ballot. In an email to Equality California supporters, Executive Director Roland Palencia said, Given what we know about public opinion and the significant challenges of the current political and economic climate, Equality California will not lead an effort to return to the ballot in 2012 to overturn Proposition 8. Another advocacy group, Love, Honor, Cherish, said that it would fill the void if Equality California, quote, abdicates its responsibility to fight for equality for the LGBT community here in California. Almost immediately following this announcement, Roland Palencia, the recently appointed executive director of Equality California, resigned and stepped down just this last Friday. Equality California announced the move last Monday evening in an email reported by the San Francisco Chronicle. Equality California said it would release a transition plan by the end of this week. And if you have news or an event you'd like to share with our listeners, be sure to tell us about it by going to our website at outbeatradio.com. Just click on Outbeat News. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Outbeat Collage with Michaela Kennan and Gary Carnevale.
Thank you, Greg, and welcome back. Michaela Kennan here, your host for the evening. I had the opportunity recently to talk one-on-one with Bay Area artist and social activist Lenore Chin. Her story is also her personal journey. Let's take a listen.
I'm very pleased to have on the line San Francisco-based artist and activist Lenore Chin, who has literally spent a lifetime challenging social norms and raising our collective consciousnesses through her art, public speaking, academic and cultural contributions, and even political and social activism. I will tell you, Lenore is one dynamo of a lady who very early on was exposed to the socio-cultural challenge of living within a traditional family structure while at the same time growing up in an urban landscape that was itself evolving with an influx of new faces, ethnicities, races, just differing world views. It had the effect to set the stage for a personal odyssey, which over time fostered her insatiable appetite for understanding rituals and traditions of people from very diverse backgrounds and beliefs. All of this helped shape and form an identity as compelling and shaped her identity, I should say, as a compelling and accomplished visual artist. Lenore, glad you could be with us, and welcome to Outbeat Collage and KRCB Radio.
Thanks for having me on your program today.
Well, it's my pleasure. I've been looking over the activity list you sent me. You've been a very, very busy person these last several months. We're talking gallery openings, speaking engagements, cultural events. What would you say was more or less the common message thread you've been weaving through all these various places and appearances?
I think for me, art is my life, and that means going beyond the easel. It's not just what I produce in terms of my painting or photography. I move in many communities, and I'm very involved in the arts communities, and I move across neighborhoods. So for me, that's a day-to-day kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And my speaking engagements or involvement with various art groups, that's all part of the mix.
I see. Well, let's add some backstory to all of this and kind of start from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So you were born in San Francisco near the Tenderloin District. Father and mother were both raised in Chinatown, your father in San Francisco, mother in Oakland. Your family lived in the Russian Hill area, and then when you were about 2 years old, they made a life-changing decision to move to the outer Richmond district.
Correct.
Why was that a significant life change?
Well, we're talking 1951, so that was quite a different city then. People often think of San Francisco as a very liberal, open-minded city, but that was not necessarily true in that era. At the time that my folks made that decision, they actually had tried to buy down the peninsula, but they ran into a heavy resistance. So my father, kept looking around, and he found a spot in the outer Richmond district. And in those days, there were virtually no people of color. Mm-hmm. So it was significant in the sense that we came into a neighborhood that was not particularly welcoming at the time. And so we were one of the first families of Chinese-American descent then to move into that neighborhood.
Were they overt about this? I mean, did you feel actual presence?
Well, In a lot of ways, I think my brother and I were sheltered or protected, you know, from some of the worst incidents that were encountered by my folks. I learned about certain things that happened, you know, as I became an adult and could understand this a little bit more fully and could look back on some of the things that had happened. I remember my father saying at one point in the early days, and when they bought the house, that they were warned, perhaps by the people who helped them buy the place, sort of almost surreptitiously through a third party, you better put a 2x4 against the back of your garage door.
Oh, wow.
And I know that the other early families that moved out there who were also Chinese American received death threats.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different neighborhood now.
Wow.
Heavily Asian, might add.
Yeah, how interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're talking mid-50s where there were really distinct ethnic background or ethnic boundaries.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And my understanding is that, you know, not even the real estate people were the ones who would encourage you to do this.
Oh, no. No, I'm sure people thought my father and mother were, you know, really pushing it, you know, making that move.
Sure.
But,
sure.
You know, my dad had said that since he ran into the obstacle down the peninsula, when it started to happen again, he decided he was not going to move.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're just going to stay there.
Wow.
Yeah.
So can you give some specific examples on maybe some of the personal or cultural challenges that presented for...
Well, you know, as a child, I didn't really think about the things that were going on. You know, in retrospect, I realized, you know, certain things were going on because there were so few people of color in those days. I think what happened is we tended to hang out with each other when we, you know, interacted in... you know, grammar school or whatever. It got more integrated over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But in the early days, there were very few of us. No African Americans, no Latinos, really. Just a handful of Asians, Japanese and Chinese Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of them tended to be my schoolmates when I was very young. And so I think that those experiences tended to shape my early life in terms of interacting with other cultures.
So you were still trying to maintain your Chinese identity, growing up within a traditional framework of family and community.
Mm-hmm.
But from your perspective, I guess I'm thinking of maybe being 4 or 5 years old and seeing someone who had a different color skin than you did or
mm-hmm.
did something different. Were there any those little early experiences that you specifically remember kind of opened your eyes to other ways?
Well, you know, I grew up sort of in a way sort of a bicultural experience because I had the Chinese traditional influences, although there were very few Chinese out there in the Richmond. I come from a very, very large extended family.
Mm-hmm.
I only had one brother, but I had my parents had a number of siblings, and so, you know, my interaction with my culture was basically through my family.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had the usual running down to Chinatown on weekends to, you know, get groceries or participate in various gatherings and that sort of thing.
Sure, sure. So from an early age, did any of this start to plant the seeds for your own kind of artistic leanings or interests?
Well, I don't know if I was consciously aware of them at the
sure.
time,
mm-hmm.
but as I went through junior high and high school and there were more families of color who, if they were not living in the neighborhood, were going to the public schools.
Yeah.
And so I had those kinds of interactions.
So you move on then to study art in college, where
mm-hmm.
you know, as we would all experience, a whole different level of influences and worldviews. How did that start to help kind of solidify your own sense of self and maybe shape some of those artistic senses?
Well, I think some of this was a carryover from my earlier public schools, because by the time I got to George Washington High School in San Francisco, there were more there were more races going to the public schools. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to college, some of those friends, you know, came from high school and went to City College. That's where I started. I started at City College of San Francisco in the advertising and design department. And then I was introduced to sociology through an African-American friend from high school. Mm-hmm. So that kind of opened things up a bit.
Sure.
Also, it was, you know, the we were in the during the Vietnam War. That was going on then.
Mm-hmm. I know I started out in psych. I actually went back to school midlife, and I started out in psychology, but found that it was a little too reductionistic.
Mm-hmm.
So sociology became my major.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That and in both undergrad and graduate school. What was cool about it was that it was such a large umbrella that I could really incorporate a lot of my own personal interests. So I could deal with things like religion. I could deal with the psychology. I could deal with,
yeah,
you know, various socioeconomic and cultural differences, and it all fit nicely under that sociological
mm-hmm.
perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it to be very helpful. And to this day, it ended up providing me with language and a framework to, you know, kind of put around ideas and views I had always had but
mm-hmm.
didn't have words for. So I really did enjoy sociology, and I use it daily, just in many, many ways you wouldn't expect.
I think, you know, the early influence of that combined with the era, you know, of the Vietnam War and all the turmoil on college campuses across the country,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then it, this was the early days, you know, it was just predates the Black Studies, Asian American Studies, all of those things that did not exist prior to that, you know. So I think it opened the door for sort of rethinking what academia could offer students.
Right, and I think even women's programs.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And was this the point where your artwork started to take on some kind of political relevance or political messages?
Well, I think because some of this actually started when I was probably in high school and then in City College. I was hanging out with a friend of mine who is disabled, and so I would wheel her from her classes around the college campuses, which was pretty hilly. It still is. And I would essentially sit in on a lot of those sociology classes she was taking, and so I was introduced to some other realities and different you know, viewpoints, and I think that too sort of came into how I looked at the world.
Yeah.
And as I was studying, a lot of that was incorporated into, you know, some of the class exercises I was doing, you know, because of the readings that I was exposed to.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
When did you first start to display your art publicly? And
I would say the mid to late 70s when I started entering Drake competitions. I entered one at it was part of the San Francisco Arts Festival in 1977, and I submitted a work for an open competition for Bay Area artists to, you know, that was destined for the San Francisco International Airport. So I was one of 10 artists who received an award, and it was a purchase award. So that was the first thing out of the gate.
And was that displayed in the airport then?
Yeah, it went up in the airport. There's a backstory to that, which I won't go into. But it took a number of years before the painting actually went up. But it was up at the airport for quite a few years.
Interesting. And what was the medium?
It was acrylics. Mm-hmm. Acrylics on canvas.
Okay. All right, excellent. So you move into the Castro district
mm-hmm.
around the early 80s.
Right.
That was an interesting time to be there.
Yes, because it was just at the beginning. We didn't see it coming, but it really was just before we began to realize that we had a disease that was coming through the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that kind of surfaced in the late 70s, early 80s, depending on how far back you look at the epidemiology.
Sure. And I think they kind of called it a cancer.
Yeah, they called it a gay cancer for a while.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the attitudes at that point were people, were they politically savvy? Were they just kind of forming their own sort of cultural?
Well, just prior to that, I would say that there was a lot of confusion. There was a lot of fear, and that fed into how the community and public officials responded. There were issues around, whether to keep the baths open or shut them down.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of confusion about the information that was getting out there. And so in a lot of ways, while there were some lesbians and gays, primarily gay men, who had gotten into positions where they could have some sort of a voice at City Hall, that was very, very early on, and so the community was just beginning to figure out how to respond to it, and it really was, flying by the seat of your pants. We learned as we went along, and we jumped in, wherever we thought we could, be of some service to
mm-hmm.
the community.
Mm-hmm. And how did your art begin to reflect that time and that political and social climate?
Well, because a lot of my work had centered around portraits or depictions of my friends in my various communities, as some of them became ill, it turned out years later that it appeared that my work was documenting the evolution of the queer community and the things that were going on at the time. And so a number of the early portraits that I was doing, either because they were subjects I selected or because I was doing commissioned work, portraits, mm-hmm. For commission, they tended to reflect the era.
Sure.
And so a lot of the, particularly the guys, the gay men in my, body of work are no longer around. And so when I give talks about my work, especially on college campuses, and the students sort of become acquainted with these figures as I'm telling them, these are people who were friends of mine and all of that. By the time I get to the end of my presentation, they realize most of them are gone.
Wow. And this was, you were kind of making inroads in the fine arts arena at this point.
A little bit, yeah. Because I was, at the same time, I was sending out slides, color slides in those days, to various juried competitions, and they were not necessarily in those days competitions that were overtly lesbian or gay.
Mm-hmm.
They were just competitions across the country where I was submitting essentially my portraiture, or the paintings that sort of depicted my various friends.
Uh-huh.
And so in that sense, one of the things that we had talked about was the fact that on the surface, the style is not particularly threatening, but I think a gay audience would recognize themselves in these paintings.
Sure.
And some who were not from our community might actually feel threatened because it touches on themes that they're not comfortable with.
Right, right. You did, though, I read in one of your parts of your bio, you used something called a non-confrontational aesthetic, which
mm-hmm.
I think is a fabulous term. And it has that way of engaging the viewer without necessarily frightening them.
Right.
So, that's a fabulous word. I may actually borrow that several times.
Oh, feel free.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, so bringing us up today, then. Your resume is almost an exhaustive review of, just exhibitions, whether singularly or as part of a group effort, curatorial, jurying experience, literary, social media contributions. Boy, speaking engagements, it almost looks as though you came into this world with kind of a plan and a purpose in mind. Did you ever think about doing something besides art or activism?
Well, when I was in college, I thought about, I actually had started a teaching credential program for elementary school, but in those days, really, there were no jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so ultimately, after I got my BA in sociology, I left to take a job as in an advertising firm, and that really, ultimately, it didn't pan out because the guy had to close the business and various things happened. So I just continued working. I was working in healthcare in a non-art related job, and that essentially subsidized my painting.
Right, right. Your dad was a mathematician and academic, obviously. Mm-hmm. Did he encourage you to go a more academic route, or?
No, essentially he kind of left me alone. I think my mother was being more the practical parent in the family. I think she was concerned about, you know, how does a person who is, you know, studying art make a living? I think that, and I think it comes from her generation as a first generation Chinese American, you know, and a woman.
Yeah.
And so, you know, her thoughts were, gee, you know, maybe you should focus on something like teaching, or, you know, something where she thought I could get gainful employment.
Mm-hmm.
And so for her, I think she finally came to terms with my choices after she decided, okay, I've got a solid job, you know, working in healthcare. And so she didn't have to worry about that aspect. Mm-hmm. And then I think as I began to, you know, get my work out there in public and all of that, then, you know, she kind of came around.
Yeah, yeah. I know my 79-year-old father, who is from the Midwest, still thinks I'm playing.
Oh, yeah, right. When are you going to grow up?
Yeah, yeah. What's your daughter do? Well, I don't know. She's out playing in California.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So I know a lot of artists who are interested in contributing aesthetically to the world. You know, mm-hmm. they try to perfect their craft. They want to make the next very best still life or landscape painting. They've not been drawn to that kind of mission where they use their art as a medium for social awareness or change.
Mm-hmm.
You, on the other hand, have done that. Does it seem as that, maybe, are you answering kind of a maybe higher calling or a purpose, or did you sort of just take advantage of the socio-political cultural richness around you and kind of go for it?
Well, perhaps a little of both, although I can't say that it was like something that I mapped out, mm-hmm. you know, in a deliberate fashion. For me, I think I just followed my interests. And left to my own devices, you know, I figured out a way that would make things work for me.
Yeah.
I was not happy, for instance, doing advertising, art, and design as a vocation, but I picked up a lot of skills along the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got introduced to photography and any number of things. Today, it's technology, so those are tools for the kind of art that I wanted to, you know, delve into. You know, some people who are interested in art, you know, they want to get their portfolio together and they want to get into a gallery or a museum or that kind of thing, which, you know, that's fine, although it's very, very difficult. But when I give talks or I have an opportunity to engage, you know, young people about art and what they want to do, what I try to do, rather than tell them how they should do something or what they should do, is, you know, to keep an open mind that there's a number of ways to get your art out there, and they should find something that reflects their true passion and you know, their voice.
Mm-hmm.
They should, you know, figure out who they want to be and how art is in their lives and how they want to define it and kind of go from there. They have to carve their own path. There's no set formula.
Yeah, excellent advice. Gosh.
Mm-hmm.
It brings to mind the power of art. Talk a little bit about that. I guess I'm asking, is it okay to just kind of sit back and create pretty things, or do we all really need to do more with the talents and kind of the internal sensibilities we have?
Well, again, I think it depends on the individual, because I don't want to take away from those who do just want to, you know, get out there in the more commercial realm and use their gifts that way. But I think I would encourage people to, you know, take a look around them and see what is that they want to do with their art production. You know, you can, you know, paint pretty pictures and do that sort of thing for, you know, different groups or organizations or, you know, a job or whatever. But, you know, in my experience, I find that limiting in terms of the rewards that it brings back for yourself, you know, to me, it's not about the money. For money, I had the day job that had nothing to do with art. And for me, that allowed me a great liberty to focus on how I wanted to use my art as my primary expressive medium, my painting.
Sure, sure. So what are some of the key organizations or groups you're affiliated with now?
Well, I've been a member of the Asian American Women Artists Association for almost 20 years. And I'm also affiliated with the Asian Pacific Islander Cultural Center, which published my book earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two primary ones. I used to be involved with Queer Cultural Center. I was the president for a number of years. And I'm still sort of involved, on the sort of the sidelines, from time to time. But that's basically it.
Right, right. I'm getting kind of the engineering cue here to wind things up.
All right.
Are you showing anywhere currently?
I'm not showing currently, but I'm working on an individual artist commission. I got a grant from the Arts Commission, and I will be showing at the Luggage Store next June.
Ah, good.
Yeah.
Good. And if we want to find out more about Lenore Chin and keep up with what you're doing?
Well, people can either go to my website, which unfortunately I don't really update because I spend more time on Facebook with my updates. But they can, check out my name,
sure.
Google it, and they'll find my website.
Uh-huh. Okay, and it's Lenore, L-E-N-O-R-E, Chin, C-H-I-N-N.
Right.
So go to Facebook and find out the updated version on that.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you'd like to just kind of touch on before we close or...
No, I just, encourage people to do their art and not let people say they can't. Find their own voice,
mm-hmm.
and stick to it.
Mm-hmm. And stick to it. That's
yeah.
the whole idea.
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Lenore, I really appreciate and the opportunity to just chat with you and kind of get to know you. I know we've had some email communication,
mm-hmm.
but it's been a real delight and pleasure. Your story is inspiring to me personally, kind of a call to action for all of us to do more and be bigger in our world than we think we often are or than
mm-hmm.
we think we can be. I really, really appreciate what you're doing, and please keep up the good work, okay?
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us here on Outbeat Collage and KRCB Radio. I look forward to staying in touch, okay?
Great. Thanks a lot.
And you're listening to KRCB Radio 91.1 and 90.9 FM. The Bay Area Wine and Epicurean Auction is coming to KRCB Television 22 this weekend and next. It started at 7 o'clock this evening for today. It will be continuing until 11 o'clock tonight and then again next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday evenings. Be the high bidder on one of many unique wines and fine dining experiences, like Bocce Wine Food and Friends for 8 people from Trinchero Family Estates in St. Helena, valued at $1,600 with an opening bid of just $700. Preview and bid online right now at krcb.org/auction. Then tune in this weekend and next, again beginning Friday at 7 p.m. It's the Bay Area Wine and Epicurean Auction on your North Bay Public Media Connection, KRCB Television, Cable 22. And now, back to Michaela Kennan and Outbeat Collage.
Thanks very much, Mary. Jan Ogren, sitting here in studio with me, is a psychotherapist, public speaker, and now author of a brand new book entitled Dividing Worlds, about one woman's journey towards spiritual enlightenment with, of course, the help of many along the way. Jan personally has studied with Native American teachers for over 30 years, and I dare say has been on a journey of her own with respect to healing and enlightenment. Jan, it's great to have you with us tonight.
Oh, it's great to be back on Outbeat Salon, and yes, it's certainly life is a journey.
What was your motivation or maybe inspiration for writing this book, Dividing Worlds?
I'd say foremost, hope for the future, because it's a difficult time we're living in now. And the book is a positive story about personal and global transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I like to just normalize that all of us try to live one life, and we have other things nudging us. In this book, it happens to be spirits, an Irish ghost here, a mystical bear there. But it's the it's just that we all have different things in life that we try to balance, and I like to normalize that nobody lives a normal life.
That's right. So give us a little bit more detail about the storyline.
It's a story about Miranda, mm-hmm. who, as I've said, she just wants to live a normal life with her partner, but she has a spirit guide that insists she go to a pharmaceutical conference, and she doesn't know why she's there. But then she has these guardian spirits start talking to her because their cave is buried underneath the pharmaceutical company's manufacturing plant.
Of course.
And that
plot thickens.
Yes, that the adventure starts there.
Uh-huh.
And so she tries to help these guardian spirits while not messing with her job or her relationship. And then she has the typical self-destructive tendencies that many of us have. And so she gets a little help along the way from, like I said, she has a spirit cat and mm-hmm. then the Irish ghost. And she evolves with also a help of a physicist and his wife, who's a mystic. Mm-hmm. And so there are many different journeys within the book.
Wonderful. You actually utilize some real solid metaphysical principles with respect to Miranda's communication and her guides. One, that she's consciously aware of them. Two, that she consciously interacts with them, albeit telepathically or intuitively. And she struggles because they don't always give her the direct answer that she wants. We all struggle with that, don't we?
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that from the book, because a lot of times people think, well, if a spirit talks to me, it'll just come through with absolute answers, like mm-hmm. God speaking and all. But the reality is there's a continuum. We all kind of have this intuition, this higher sense of knowing, and we sometimes listen to it, and we sometimes don't, and we usually regret it when we don't listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really normalizing that it's not like, I help people a lot, both as a psychotherapist and then just personally, or people who want to understand and connect more to either spirits or the natural world. And it's all there for us. It's just that most people discount it so
mm-hmm.
much.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a story about Miranda discounts it. She struggles with it. It doesn't come through clearly. She's not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also, in the book, she's a Unitarian Universalist, which is a very liberal religion
mm-hmm.
that focuses more on questions and answers. So it fits right in for her.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, that was how, in the book she was raised, and I am a Unitarian also, so that fit in.
Speaking a little personal experience there?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, always.
There's a lot of personal experience in this book.
No doubt. So you wrote Dividing Worlds as a fictional account. You consider yourself a storyteller. Talk to us a little bit about the power of the spoken word and your experience as one who speaks.
Okay. I think I actually will. I want to read a quote from Ursula Le Guin, because she's this master storyteller. And she's talked about how words are used or not used and how we listen or not. And so Ursula Le Guin talks about, by climbing up into his head and shutting out every voice but his own, civilized man has gone deaf. He can't hear the wolf calling him brother. Not master, but brother. He can't hear the earth calling him child, not father, but son. This myth of civilization embodied in the monotheism, which assigns soul to man alone, is basically how man has crawled up into his head, and I'm not quoting anymore, and tuned out the trees, the earth,
mm-hmm.
all spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love the way that Ursula Le Guin talks about, if we climb up into our head and we're rational, we miss so much.
That age of reason.
Mm-hmm.
I just today was listening to Carolyn Mays.
Uh-huh, yes.
And she was doing an interview, and she said, we are at the end of the age of reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because reason, as in scientific answers and absolutes, no longer serves us.
Yeah.
And we're finding that. We're asking lots of questions. We're not getting the direct answers anymore. And nothing that we ever thought we knew is the way it really is. And
mm-hmm.
we're finding that out daily. So it's...
Yeah. And, my background actually is in neuroscience. So I do very much consider myself a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem that we often think of rational as materialistic, and so if it can't be found in the material world, then we discount it.
Right.
And there's so much more than that. But we can still use our consciousness, use our ability to reason. We just need to go beyond.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And not believe that what we can literally see, taste, sense, mm-hmm. and hear, you know, with our five senses is the end of it.
Yes, exactly.
It's actually just the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You incorporate many aspects of Native American teachings in Miranda's dealings with her guides. You also flesh out to the reader in a virtually a primer-like way what it's like to see subtle energy forms, become attuned to vibrations, intuition. Where does that come from within the scope of your personal journey of experience?
Well, I always had the sense that there was something else growing up, and I just never had any form for it. I studied a lot of different religions, and nothing ever explained why I could feel things, mm-hmm. and I didn't have the rational words for it until I started apprenticing with Native American.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, within their circle of being, they include trees, they include plants. And so I started just paying attention. And I noticed that if I paid attention to the weather, I could get a pretty good sense, better than the weathermen's,
mm-hmm.
of what the weather was going to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it just, and I had one Native American who I was saying, well, if I tuned in, I could find parking spaces. And then he said, you know, you can use it for stoplights, too. And so, you know, if I kind of get in tune and I see a stoplight that's red, I kind of ask for it to be green, and it's amazing.
And it turns?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a really practical aspect.
Tell us a little bit more from your perspective as a writer. What was it like to create these characters and develop their personalities?
Well, as a writer, it's amazing that if I get out of the way, the characters develop themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to specifically mention Chris, who's Miranda's partner. And I really wanted that to honor the transgender community,
mm-hmm.
and also recognition of bisexuality, because I hate to ruin the book before people read it, but one of the things about in the book, Chris is never genderized. And it's fascinating because I've had people come back to me and said they love that about mm-hmm. the fact that Chris never has a gender. And then it's fascinating how people will come to me and just say, oh, Chris, he did that or she did that. And they
yeah.
were automatically assigned a gender and be shocked when I tell them that there is that was purely from their own perception.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so Chris is, I think, an interesting character in there. Because Chris is really open to whoever people want to see Chris as.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're, on some level, uncomfortable with that because we like to categorize. It helps us if we know how to refer to someone as a he or a she or the Unitarian or the this mm-hmm. or that. Those labels.
Yeah.
Yeah, they get us in trouble, don't they?
Oh, I know, and that's why, as a psychotherapist, I work with a lot of individuals in the transgender community, and that is such a huge challenge mm-hmm. to go against the gender culture.
Sure.
And it's just such a huge thing. The first thing when a baby's born is you want to know he or she.
Uh-huh. And pink or blue. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then bisexuality is such a difficult concept. You know, and so... People can decide, the gender of Chris or not, or leave it open.
Right.
And some people really like having it be open, which is really fun. And, I mean, now that you know that part of the book, you can have fun if you give it to a friend, and then later on don't tell them about mm-hmm. it, and then ask them, so describe Chris to me, and see what they say.
Yeah, that would be fun. It'd be great if you could somehow get the statistics on that. Or
yeah.
Who is
mm-hmm.
Chris, you know,
mm-hmm.
for her.
Well, I have done it quite a bit, and I've noticed, you know, that certain people will, you know, definitely, and, you know, say he, she, depending on their bias. So.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. The dedication in your book reads, to all of those who believe in the reality of a global consciousness shift. I love that phrase. Tell me what you mean by global consciousness shift.
Well, Global consciousness is when a huge culture holds an idea. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you go back to when everyone believed the world was flat, mm-hmm. and that was a consciousness. And now, you know, people have the consciousnesses round. Used to believe that the sun was or the earth was the center, and then the shift, the sun being the center. These are all major shifts in worldview. And right now, our consciousness as a collective species is very much about war and threat and survival. And what a lot of people are seeing, and I'm seeing, is that there is a possibility of a shift towards connection and healing and wholeness. Mm-hmm. And that's what I write about in the book, and that's what I see as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's what I see is necessary.
Mm-hmm. You work primarily with adults in your practice, or do you work with young people as well?
I definitely work with teenagers, some children, but mostly it's adults.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. What do you notice about the young kids as compared to the adults in terms of their vision of the future, their hope for a different life or, an adult life?
Well, it's amazing in terms of the openness and certainly what we're talking about with gender mm-hmm. consciousness. I mean, the teenagers today are much more open than certainly I grew up. But I think the younger people it's a serious challenge.
Are they optimistic?
It depends on the groups. Mm-hmm. You know, I just came from, there's a coming of age ceremony. At the Unitarian Universalists are having. And that's a wonderful, these 40 young people getting together and really consciously looking at where's their place in the world and bonding together and supporting each other to be unique individuals. And mm-hmm. these are basically 14-year-olds. And so there's a lot of hope there. In my practice, you know, I see more kids struggling.
Sure.
Peer pressure, drugs is a huge thing. Video, there's actually now a disorder called nature deprivation disorder.
Oh.
Meaning that kids don't get outside.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Sunlight in their face.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You're also connected with the Institute of Noetic Science, which is based in Petaluma. Can you give us a quick definition of what noetic science is?
It's the study of consciousness, and that Noetic Science Institute was founded by Edgar Mitchell, who's Apollo 14 astronaut, mm-hmm. and he saw the Earth rise while he was on the moon, and he had this amazing experience of just this oneness of knowing that everything was connected,
mm-hmm.
and he was an astronaut, he was a scientist, and he had no idea what to do with this very profound spiritual experience. So he came back and founded the Institute to study consciousness, which is still a huge mystery, mm-hmm. as how do we think? Mm-hmm. We might understand the brain better, but we still don't understand how we think. So it's an amazing place, and you can find it at noetic.org, mm-hmm. noetic.org. And they're basically studying consciousness. They're pioneers in blending the paranormal with the scientific.
Mm-hmm. I've been there, too, and there's a lot of lectures and mm-hmm. Reading material there that you can just download and get a good sense of what it's all about, start your own exploration.
Yes.
You'll be doing a book reading and a meditation there soon.
Yes. I was thrilled to be invited on November 17th.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a Thursday. And for people who can come early, I'm going to be walking a labyrinth that they have, a beautiful labyrinth under the oak trees. And I'm going to be there at 4:30. But then there's a social event, gathering and food, at 5:30. And then going to do a little bit after 6 to 7, do a talk and meditation. And people are invited to come whenever they can.
Mm-hmm.
And you can all find it under noetic.org or under my website, janogren.net.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very special because the spirits in the book, Dividing Worlds, are actually the grandmother guardians, are the guardians of the Earth there at the Noetic Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
So they are, as I say in the book, it's a fictional book, but it's based on reality. and these spirits are real. They're real to me and real to themselves, I would say.
And to and a lot of people, I'm sure.
Yes, yeah, and you can feel them. So if you come up there, people just feel the land is beautiful there.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned also that your intention in writing the book was to help facilitate a global consciousness shift where the guiding principle is health, not survival. It seems many of us these days are in that survival mode. Would you expand a little bit on that, on this idea of health? How do we move from a survival mode into that of healthy living?
Well, that's where I bring in my neuroscience and combine it with my psychotherapy. Because we actually know enough about the brain and the brainstem that we're still wired to live in the jungle. And that makes it really hard living in this world, having relationships and work, when we get triggered just by, you know, thoughts of, oh, I'll lose my job. Well, that goes to survival, and we pump in adrenaline, which means we think less and we react more, and that doesn't always help with work mm-hmm. or relationships. And so we've found through many different processes, but I use something called EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, to help clients actually rewire their brainstem so that they no longer react in survival mode but in connection. And it's and I've done it myself. I do everything myself before sharing it with others. And it's really amazing to just no longer have the old triggers that say danger. You know, I've got to react this way, or I have to reject her before she rejects me, or I have to...
Flight or fight.
Yeah.
Flight or fight, mm-hmm. fight or flight.
Yeah, fight, flight, freeze, or please.
Ah.
Those are our four automatic responses. And I also do, I practice Aikido, mm-hmm. and I blend it into my practice, and I show people how physically that's how they automatically respond. They're either going to have anger, they're going to have fear, they're going to, you know, fear is usually flight or flight, and then this pleasing, mm-hmm. which is none of them are as strong as centering. So I find that just talking doesn't work as well as actually doing the reprogramming of the neural responses. And it's one, I mean, it's it'd be a whole show in itself.
Sure, but just a technique.
Yeah, but that is something that the more people who are doing it individually, then globally, we can do it.
Is that like rapid eye movement?
Yes, it is.
Is that what it
yeah.
is?
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the EMDR. And I also have some links on my website mm-hmm. to places, too.
Okay, all right. So for someone who's new to these concepts or just beginning to kind of shift and become aware, how might reading this book or even coming to the reading and meditation be of benefit? How is that going to help them?
Well, I wrote it as a novel because it's fun to read novels. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that the mind kind of... the critical mind takes a little bit of a break whenever you say once upon a time you start reading because I'm trying to lay out a world that is possible for people mm-hmm. and one of the things I've discovered through being a psychotherapist is a lot of people have had what they call strange or different experiences that they're afraid to share with other people because they don't want to be called crazy, they don't want drugs, but it's, you know, a lot of people have had them. And so here I've got a character who's having them, trying to balance it out. Who should she tell? Who should she not tell what she's experiencing? Mm-hmm. And it also, it's something that Carlos Castaneda did really well when he wrote his Tales of Power, is he said, you just have to hear these amazing things. And the more amazing things you hear, the more normal they become. Mm-hmm. And we need more magic. And we need to have people realizing that miracles are happening and the earth just living is a miracle. Mm-hmm. And so we need the positive tales because, you know, that's why I love public radio. It's has, you know, much better than the commercial
sure.
news. And we need to just have a nice book that we can read that takes us into a world where there's a transformation that's happening and
yeah.
that is possible.
Yeah, and again, I think that's one of the wonderful things about your book, apart from the storyline, is just, as you said earlier, you tend to normalize these experiences of paying attention to the intuitive, more subtle messages that you're getting. And that's of great value, because I think as a globe and in this time of consciousness shifting, we're moving more in to that realm of communication with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a...
And there's actually amazing, you know, I really recommend checking out Noetic Sciences,
mm-hmm.
because what they're studying and what they're finding and documenting scientifically is just great.
Yeah, I agree. And it's going to give you the basis of the formality, you know, the science and groundedness that you're looking mm-hmm. for. But at the same time, it's going to leave a lot of room for you to bring in other elements that we've been talking about. So mm-hmm. kind of the visible and the invisible in one time or in one space. I think it's fabulous. So let's recap. We'll be doing a reading and meditation on November 17th,
mm-hmm.
the time.
Anytime at 4:30, there's a walk around the labyrinth.
Mm-hmm.
At 5:30, there's could be social.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little after 6 to 7, there'll be the reading and meditation, and then there'll be a book signing and question and answer after that. So people can come whenever it works for work.
Mm-hmm. And where else can we find your book?
It's going to be at Copperfields in Sebastopol. Not the other Copperfields, but Sebastopol.
Excellent.
And also local coffee shops like Muffin Street Baking mm-hmm. And Mission Circle.
Okay.
That a lot of different local coffee shops are now having local authors' mm-hmm. books,
mm-hmm.
which is wonderful. And then you can also get it electronically.
Mm-hmm.
So environmentally, it's on Kindle and all other electronic mediums.
Oh, good. And Amazon.
And Amazon.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. And then if someone wanted to find out more about you, your practice, they can reach you at?
JanOgren.net.
Okay.
Has an email. And then my phone number is 707-544-7756.
Okay. All right. Very mm-hmm. good.
And that's all on janogren.net.
Okay.
And it's OGREN.
Okay. So there you go. janogren.net. Jan, it's been an absolute pleasure. If I could shake your hand, I would. But please keep up the good work.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're doing a very valuable service. You're not only getting to write, which I know is a love, but you're bringing an important message to us, too. So appreciate the fact that you're here tonight.
Yes, definitely. And I try to, to share that.
Good,
so,
good. And
I
hope to see you around. We're going to be watching to find out if there's some book readings in other places, too. So check out the Institute of Noetic Science in Petaluma. Go to Copperfields, pick up a copy of Jan's book, Dividing Worlds. It's Christmas time. Think about the people on your Christmas list that might like to read and actually benefit from a book such as this. Tune in next month, to Outbeat Collage. Gary and I will be chatting with local writer and poet Charlie Pendergast. He is the owner of Risk Press Gallery and Risk Press Foundation in Sebastopol. Also, we'll be bringing in Outbeat's own Dr. Diana Grayer. She has just released two books for children, both of them about personal transformation and a book of affirmations and positive self-esteem for young kids. Until then, for Mary Moore Campagna, Gary Carnevelli, I'm Michaela Kennan. Remember to be real, be remarkable, do something for yourself and for someone else this week. I'll see you next time. Good night.
Os livros na estante já não têm mais tanta importância. Do muito que eu li, do pouco que eu sei, nada me resta a não ser a vontade de te encontrar. Motivo eu já nem sei, nem que seja só para estar ao seu lado, só para ler no seu rosto uma mensagem de amor.